You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. Delegate David Toscano provided his perspective on the issues that came before the 2013 legislature at the Wednesday meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. Delegates Steve Lanz, Rob Bell, and Matt Ferris were also invited to speak, but were unable to attend. Delegate David Toscano is serving his fourth term in the Virginia General Assembly. He represents the 57th District in the House of Delegates and, since 2011, has served as the House Democratic leader. David is a member of the Courts of Justice, Transportation, and Science and Technology Committees. He is also a member of the Disability Commission and has served on the Special Joint Subcommittee to Study Land Use Tools in the Commonwealth and the Joint Committee to Study Math, Science, and Engineering. He is also a member of the United Way Board. For five consecutive years, the Virginia League of Conservation Voters has named David a legislative hero for his work on environmental issues. Delegate Toscano spoke at the Wednesday, April 10, 2013 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Bill Davis.
It's my pleasure to introduce David Toscano today. Of course, you heard about Steve Landis is delayed, and hopefully he will get here. We also invited Rob Bell and Matt Ferris, and they both said they had another conflict. They had something else they had to attend. And I know Rob wanted to be here because he's always been a good, strong supporter of SSV, and he's always been happy to come and present to us whenever we've asked him. So it wasn't because he was staying away for some reason. Everybody knows our citizen legislature, who is the true person to that title. He does have a law practice, a busy law practice, but yet he takes his time to represent us down in Richmond in the General Assembly. He also is serving as the minority leader in the House of Delegates. So I'm very proud to introduce David Toscano, who will talk about the recent session.
I can take this off, I think, right? I'm not going to sing it, don't worry. Hopefully Steve will arrive soon, this is always one of the highlights for me when we come back for the session. As soon as I get the notice, I put it on my calendar, and, it sits there, and I'm glad to come out again. I have to, I'll say a few words about my colleague, Rob Bell, who has a law office above mine downtown. We kind of joke with each other. Oftentimes we're on the panels together, and we know what we're going to say so much that we could probably play ourselves on TV. So if you want me to try to articulate his point of view on things, I can try to do that. I would try to be fair to him like I think he would try to be fair to me. It would be good for Steve to be here because, as you know, I'm a Democrat, and Steve, of course, is a Republican, and so you're going to get different points of view. To the extent I can try to be fair to both sides, I will. I'm just finishing my eighth year. It's hard to believe. My second year as the Democratic leader in the Virginia House. I think most of you know I represent the entire city of Charlottesville and a portion of the urban ring in Albemarle County. 2 years ago, the redistricting occurred, and that changed my district a little bit so that I lost some folks out in the Ivy area. The district lost. It's not my district. It's your district. The district lost some people in Ivy, and it picked up some people to the south, Mill Creek, Renovia, those sorts of areas of Otakale, and some folks in the Woodbrook area. So I'm pleased with the folks that I now get to represent, but as I've told you many, many times before, when I push the button down there, I try to think just broader than my district alone. I try to think of the broader region, and I also try to think about the Commonwealth. And in fact, that's a perfect segue to what the kinds of things that were important and that we discussed in this session of General Assembly. As you know, this is the second year of the biennium, and that means that it is the so-called short session. the session that only takes 45 days as opposed to the 60-day session we do in the even-numbered years. So when the legislature was originally set up, that short session was only designed to tweak the budget, the two-year budget that we passed the year before. And over the years, it sort of morphed into a totally new session with all these bills being introduced. And instead of having 60 days to deal with all these bills, we now have 45 days. So I don't know if that's good or bad. It does allow me to get back home a little bit earlier, but it means the days and the nights are a lot longer than they would be typically. But let's try to give you some highlights about the things that we discussed, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. I know you got lots of questions. This session will be remembered for the transportation plan. How many years have I been talking to you about a transportation plan? How many years have I been telling you that, you know, if we get some leadership, we'll have a chance at getting a transportation plan that's relatively robust, that will raise enough money, that will be able to do some things to fix our roads, fix our bridges, build new roads where we need them, speak to our transit problems, and provide a dedicated source for passenger rail? Well, if you would have told me in January that we would come out of this session with a transportation plan that raises over $1 billion a year, I would have told you we were smoking something. Things changed, though, when Governor McDonnell made his proposal back in January for a transportation plan. At the time, a lot of us thought that it was kind of smoke and mirrors because it really didn't raise any money. But what it did was set up the dynamic that allowed us to change things along the way so we could raise some real money. And that's, in fact, what we did. And even though the governor did water down the plan toward the end in this veto session that we just finished up, that plan is still pretty robust. And it has a lot to commend for it for many people in this region. I think if you've heard Dennis Rooker come and speak to you, Ann Mallett come to speak to you about the problems that the county has with road funding, they would have told you that for a number of years now, the county, because the state hasn't been picking up its tab of the cost, has been forced to put your property tax dollars into money for roads, maintenance, paving, that sort of thing. Millions of dollars, because the state hasn't been paying its fair share. So because the state will be paying more, there will be more money that comes to Albemarle County to deal with that problem. And that's true with Augusta County and a lot of other counties in the region. Beyond that, I know a number of you probably take that nice train that leaves here and goes up into Washington and into the corridor that got established several years ago, the train that is the best performing state-sponsored Amtrak train in the entire country that was set up as a pilot program several years ago. Well, for the first time in Virginia history, we now have a dedicated source of revenue to fund passenger rail in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we've got some pretty good things in this plan, and we can go into it in more detail if you want. If you want to talk about hybrid fees, we'll talk about hybrid fees. How many people drive Priuses in this room? I saw a couple people. Okay, I've gotten a few letters about that. Well, that was one big thing that happened during the General Assembly session. The second big thing that happened in the General Assembly session for this region was the entire debate about Helen Dragas and the reappointments to the boards of visitors. Okay, now, that was really interesting. As you know, I took a very strong position about that very early, and I asked her for her to resign, and I didn't support a reappointment. That's independent of whether you might like her or not. I mean, she's a very nice person. That's not the issue. She's done a lot of nice things in Virginia Beach. That's not the issue. The issue was what happened last spring and whether that's the kind of leadership we need at the University of Virginia. So I very publicly took a position opposing that. Steve Landis actually voted against her as well. That vote failed by, I think, 63-33 in the House. And in the Senate, it was, I don't know, 30-9. So it wasn't like typical gubernatorial appointments where you come out with a 100-0 vote or a 40-0 vote. There was a lot of angst about that reappointment. We did try to put through some bills related to governance of the University of Virginia. For the most part, they failed. There was a bill that Steve had put in that required some better education for boards of visitors, a bill that I supported. That bill passed out of the House but got morphed into a sort of a watered-down version that required the boards to be more transparent in the decision-making process. Interestingly enough, I had a bill that would have required any major decision to be made by a quorum of the board defined as a majority of the members. Now, isn't that an interesting concept, that a quorum? But you know that bill got killed. God only knows why. So the Helen Dragas issue and the University of Virginia was another thing that we dealt with. I don't want to minimize other things that we did or didn't do. We're talking about photo ID if you want. We can talk about guns. We can talk about choice. We can talk about all those things. But the third takeaway, in my view, is this whole debate about Medicaid. as you know, the Republican governor, Governor McDonnell, has taken a pretty strong position in opposing the expansion of Medicaid in Virginia. In the aftermath of the Supreme Court decision, as you know, the Supreme Court left the option with the states whether or not they would expand Medicaid. The federal health care bill allows states to expand Medicaid, and in the first 3 years, the feds will pay 100% of the additional costs. And then in years after that, it drops to 90, and then I don't know if it's the eighth year or the seventh year. It goes back to the way it's usually funded, which now is 50% from the state, 50% from the federal government. So a number of us who are concerned about the uninsured in our community, and especially concerned for the status of some of our major teaching hospitals like UVA, who have to essentially take people to come into emergency rooms and get served, we thought, oh, this is a good thing. We can insure another 300,000 Virginians. We can create another 30,000 jobs, which was projected to be the job creation that would be generated by this expansion. We could bring $9 billion to the Commonwealth of Virginia. We could have your taxpayer dollars that are now going to D.C. that are going then out to Connecticut or New York or California or whatever state is choosing to expand Medicaid and bring some of those dollars back here so they can be utilized to help people who live in your communities. We could take some of the pressure off the emergency rooms who have to take folks in and serve them and then ask the state for reimbursement, which comes out of your tax dollars, or if a private insurer is paying for it, you're paying higher premiums, and do something good for the Commonwealth by expanding Medicaid. Well, I think you know pretty clearly where I am on this. Well, we couldn't get there through the legislative process. So as what usually often happens, there was a compromise. And what happened at the end was there was language written into the budget, and I believe Steve supported that language, I think. You can ask him if he gets here. That set forth a sort of special joint commission composed of members of the House and members of the Senate who would recommend the expansion of Medicaid in Virginia if certain reform measures were met. And they have a series of measures that had to be met. And if that happened, then a majority of the House members on the commission and a majority of the Senate members on the commission, if they all agreed, we get Medicaid expansion. So I guess the answer is we really don't have it. We kind of have a roadmap to getting it, but it's not at all clear what happens. And depending on who the governor is next time, all things may change. So that's kind of the snapshot view of what happened in the General Assembly, at least the big points. I'm sure I probably missed some points that were major for you, and I know I'm going to hear about it through these cards. But I'm glad to take some questions, and you know, if Steve comes, hopefully I didn't misrepresent any positions he's taken in these matters. Thank you.
Okay, John McCauley will collect your cards, and Tom Boyd. And I have a question. New tax legislation, is you addressed some of that. Is there more to add to that?
I get direction well. You don't want me to break the side off? I've been covering these events for a long time. How large have you think I've gotten over those years?
It's balanced.
Okay, now it's balanced. That's where I need to be, right in the middle. That's perfect. Okay. Oh, that's right. Okay, so taxes. With the exception of the increase in the sales tax that is targeted towards transportation, there aren't any more taxes that I know of. Now, there may be some fees that get raised in the process, but any fees and taxes that I'm aware of were fees and taxes targeted to transportation. Mm-hmm. And it's important to note that those things are locked up. You cannot, we're not allowed to borrow off that transportation fund for other purposes. We're not allowed to spend money out of that transportation fund for other purposes. That's a prohibition, and that's really important because otherwise you got people using the money for another purpose. I don't know if that's responsive to the question, but that's kind of the way I read it.
Yeah, yeah. I have two questions on gerrymandering, and one was addressed to Steve Landis in particular, but they're both in the same general area. And without reading all of this, but partisan redistricting or gerrymandering distorts the result of voting, allows legislatures to pick their voters by shifting focus from general elections to primaries. It empowers the most radical members of both parties. When will you and your colleagues end this destructive practice? I know you've talked about this before, and I think we probably know your position on this, but could you talk about what can be done about gerrymandering?
Well, how many times have I told you that the way this system ought to work is that voters choose their legislators, and legislators ought not to be choosing their voters? And in fact, that's what we do. We choose our voters by drawing lines. You know, I haven't been in a position to draw the lines, so, it's easy for me to talk. But I've supported bipartisan, nonpartisan redistricting for a long time. I thought that maybe it would be this year that people could say to themselves, well, I don't really need to worry about what will happen in the next redistricting because it doesn't happen for another 10 years. And so maybe it's time to embrace a new concept. Because it's not a self-interested thing. I probably won't have to be there in 10 years, and by that time, somebody else can run. But a nonpartisan redistricting approach would probably make it less likely that we have as significant an ideological divide as we get, especially in the U.S. Congress, but to some extent in the General Assembly. And if you look at these districts now, you got some districts that are 65% or 70% Republican voting districts, and some districts that are 65% or 70% Democratic voting districts. In that kind of scenario, how is a challenger ever going to win? Now, these are House districts that are 80,000. These aren't like congressional districts, which are, 500,000? 700,000? These are small districts. And when you line up in a certain way, then the real contest is in a primary. And we know who comes out in primaries. They tend to be the most ideologically committed people. And so the most ideologically committed people in the Democratic primary are folks who are on the left of the spectrum. The most ideological people in the Republican primary tend to be on the most right of the spectrum. So you elect a Republican who is more conservative. You elect a Democrat who is more liberal, and how do they talk to each other? We need to figure out ways that we can get more into the center. And if and when I'm ever in a position where I can have an impact on this, you know, I'm going to be supporting. Even though the only way I get an impact is if we're in the majority. That's the only way it changes, I think. And even then, it's a hard thing because one of the strange things that happens, I guess, maybe it's natural, when people get in the majority, they want to stay there. And so then they start drawing the lines to support their views. Now, that's a pretty cynical view of politics. But I can tell you, if I get in a position where I can draw the lines, we're going to pass nonpartisan redistricting. It'll have to be a constitutional amendment. But we're going to go for that, and we're going to change the way politics operates in Virginia.
Okay, well, here's another impossible question to answer, but sure. I will give you the question. How do you stop or prevent the feds and the state of Virginia from mandating programs without providing supporting funding?
Well, it's very difficult to stop the feds from doing it. We do have some control over stopping the state. We basically just say, no, we're not going to do that. That's sometimes easier said than done. You know, sometimes there are things that need to be done, like in the form of certain regulations that might have to be imposed upon localities to protect the health and safety of citizens that don't have any money attached to them. But generally speaking, you know, as somebody who spent 12 years working in local government, boy, I understand what these mandates are like coming down from the state, and I generally don't support them unless there's money attached to them. But it really is discipline. You really have to say, look, this is a nice idea, but unless we're going to give the money to the localities to do it, we're not going to enact it. And I think the same problem or challenge exists at the federal system where, you know, the congressmen and senators, they just have to figure out a way to just say no occasionally.
Okay. What is the status of education funding, and what are the priorities in higher education?
Well, that's two big questions. I'll give you my sense of things. We've been underfunding education in Virginia for a while. Our K through 12 funding per student is now at levels approximating 2008. And we've been doing better than some states, but we've not been doing well enough. Our university funding, we fund our students per capita about one-third of the rate as North Carolina. Our tuitions are going through the roof because we are not putting enough state monies into higher education. So, you know, what happens when that happens is that universities have to cut or they can't raise salaries, which is happening at University of Virginia. And or they have to raise tuition, which is happening at the University of Virginia, PVCC, and other community college system. So you're getting this very dangerous, troubling situation where our educational system is being put at risk because we're not investing enough. Our teacher salaries are pretty much in the middle of the pack, even though we're, I think, eighth in terms of per capita income among all the states in the country. And, you know, we were at the university yesterday, Steve and I, and Dr. Friedman, president of PVCC, and Teresa Sullen, and we were talking about this. And I think there's a broad consensus that if we don't invest in higher education, we run the risk of not only impoverishing our youngsters who are going to school or their parents, but not turning out the kind of quality graduates that we need to allow our citizens and our country to compete in the global economy. You know, great universities just don't happen. They're products of decisions, good and bad, large and small, that show up over a period of time. University of Virginia was not at one time ranked among the top several universities in the country. It got there for a reason. The risk we have is, you know, because of a series of decisions that get made, you wake up 20 years down the road, doesn't look like the same place. And it won't happen like overnight. You won't wake up one day and just say, oh my God, look what happened. No, it'll be slow. It'll be slow, but 20 years down the road, you'll see it. So I think we have a problem in higher education. We have to try to we've marshaled some extra funds for transportation. Hopefully that will free up a little money to be more generous with education.
Would you discuss the controversy in the General Assembly about uranium mining and how that all turned out?
Oh, sure. Have you had somebody come to you to debate uranium mining? Have you had a session about that?
We have not.
You really ought to have one, because I think it's a very interesting debate, and you've got a lot of scientific knowledge on both sides of this question. As you know, the largest deposit of uranium east of the Mississippi is in Pennsylvania County, about 2.5 hours south of here. That stream is not the right word, I don't know what they call it. Vein. That vein stretches up, it goes up through central Virginia and actually goes into Orange County. But economically, you probably couldn't mine uranium in Orange County. But you could mine it in Pennsylvania. And so a lot of people were very interested in lifting a moratorium on uranium mining that had been imposed in the early 1980s by the General Assembly. A lot of money involved in this debate. A lot of lobbyists employed. And there were a couple of bills introduced in the last legislative session to do that. I think the proponents of lifting the ban recognized early on that they didn't have the votes to get the bills passed. They might not have even had the votes to get the bills out of committee. And so they pulled the bills. And there was no legislation. I don't think this is going away, however, because there's too much money involved. The proponents of uranium mining take the position it can be mined safely, and that it could bring great revenue not just to Pennsylvania County, but the entire Commonwealth of Virginia. The opponents take the position that they haven't found a safe way to mine it, and there's too much danger involved in contaminating the water supply. I'm very lucky I didn't have to vote on this thing. I mean, I think my constituents pretty clearly have told me they don't want uranium mining. But given that we don't have a bill to vote on, I encourage all of you to take a close look at it and think about it and let me know more about what you think. Because I think this is coming back. There was some fear that the governor would try to promulgate some regulations for uranium mining if it were to occur at all. I don't know whether he may try to do that in the next 6 months. I think that people would be very upset about that because it would seem to circumvent the legislative process, which is it's a popular process. Those people who elect the legislators have their say in that process. So I don't think that's a good idea. I think we need to debate whether we're going to lift the moratorium before we start imposing regulations. And until somebody can show me it's safe, I'm not going to vote to lift the moratorium.
Please comment on on Obamacare, the law that's coming into effect. When will it go into effect in Virginia, and how will it affect Virginia?
Scott, help me out. For those of you who don't know Scott Leake, he helps out Congressman Hurt, and he's helped out a lot of people, and he helps me out occasionally. He's not helping me out today. I'm just a small-town country lawyer who just serves in the Virginia General Assembly. What do I know about Obamacare? To try to get these the dates when this goes, all of these things go into effect, I won't tell you the exact dates because I don't know the exact dates, but they are... Different things are happening at certain times, and a lot of it's happening in the next year or so. The healthcare exchanges are now being sort of implemented as a hybrid between the state and the federal government. These are the exchanges that will allow people who don't have insurance now to go into the marketplace of options that would be offered by the private insurance companies and purchase options. There are subsidies that are coming to some people who are going to be able to buy private insurance. The taxes, some of them kick in pretty soon, some of them wait for a while. So, I'm not the best person to answer the question about when various things happen. What we have been worried about at the state level is expansion of Medicaid and how do we give options to people who live in the state to acquire private insurance through the marketplace in a way that they know what they're buying and from whom. One of the things we did discuss at the end of the session was whether or not a private insurance company on this exchange could offer private insurance coverage to private individuals that would prevent them from acquiring abortion coverage. And the governor sent down language at the end of the session asking us to prohibit the private companies from offering private insurance to those private individuals so they couldn't get abortion coverage. That's a little bit unusual because you're sort of really intruding in the marketplace. Both the House and the Senate passed the language, the Senate by one vote. It is what it is. And that was one thing that happened just last week.
Okay. Finally, I have a question on gun control.
God, this is like the rapid fire.
Absolutely. And I'm reading them off, folks.
If I leave at 2:15 and Steve Landis walks in the door, he'll get the next line of them?
We'll be ready for him. Virginia apparently has very lax gun control laws, which have made the states a supplier to other East Coast states that are trying to tighten their laws. What in Virginia is going on that where we would tighten our gun control laws, if anything?
We're probably not going to tighten our gun control laws in Virginia anytime soon because of the dynamic of the General Assembly and the fact that the governor would probably veto anything that got passed anyway. But let me give you some historical context. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, Virginia was the gun-running capital of the East Coast. And in response to that, Governor Wilder pushed through the infamous one gun a month law, infamous or famous, depending on your view about it. And under this law, you can only buy one gun a month. One handgun a month. That means that, and of course, last year we repealed that act. So from the time that Wilder got the act approved and the time we repealed it, you could have bought 240 guns. But the day, July 1, when that last year, you could buy 241 guns in one day. So that's how that law changed. In addition, over the last few years, we've passed a number of other bills that allow you to carry a concealed weapon into a restaurant or bar, that prohibit the public from seeing who has concealed weapons permits. So we passed a number of things that have sort of loosened the gun laws in Virginia. You all can make a judgment about whether you think that's a good or a bad thing. We have tried to place greater ability to do background checks, some of us. We think that's a good idea. That way you can do, the more instant background checks you can do, the better chance you have of keeping guns out of the hands of criminals or people who have some problems emotionally. That's being debated at the federal level. I heard today that the Senate might take a vote on this. This is a very popular measure. I think it polls at 90%. Some of us tried to reimpose the one gun a month rule. That didn't work. There was one bill that we did pass. It was pretty much of a bipartisan bill that allowed for greater penalties on those people who do what are called straw purchases of firearms, where somebody is kind of set up who's a legal person, they go and buy a firearm for somebody who's illegal, and then they pass it off to the illegal person. That one did get bipartisan support. But there, any of the so-called gun control legislation tend to get bogged down. Now, there are some things we've done in terms of mental health. I sat on a commission with Delegate Bell a couple years ago in the aftermath of Virginia Tech, and we did a lot of rewrites of the mental health laws, and we put some more money into mental health. And we put a little more money in it this year, too, but that's on the mental health side. It really it, it really has to do with problems independent of gun violence, although it spills over into the gun violence area. Long and short, I just don't see us doing much with on gun legislation. I think a lot of that's going to happen at the federal level.
This is my last question on a card. If anybody else has a question, please pass it to John or Tom. Okay, then this will probably be our last question. But areas of Norfolk and other coastal areas apparently are threatened by rising sea levels. But Virginia has no specific offshore wind power or concerted solar power development. What, if anything, is our legislature doing to develop renewable energy?
Well, we did pass a law a couple of years ago creating the Virginia Wind Power Consortium, which would allow utility companies in the state to cooperate together on trying to put wind farms off the coast. Wind is very, very expensive to generate, by which to generate electricity. We've been doing more in the area of solar. You know, I had a bill a couple of years ago that allowed Dominion to do some experiments with large-scale solar applications, primarily on rooftops, to see how the economics of that works, because a lot of us believe that solar power is more economically viable right now than wind, and it can be more diffuse and has less impact on the environment. You put a wind farm on a mountain range, and it has it has impacts on birds and bats and other things. If you put it offshore, it's a lot better. It's just more expensive. But if you can locate solar on farms, you can generate electricity that can help to fire up the grid. We passed a bill this year. Actually, it was a bill that I had put in a couple years ago, but this year was put in by a Republican. It got passed. I thought that was great. That allows incentives for farmers to use large-scale solar to generate power that's put back on the grid. It's called agricultural net metering. That is, if you generate more off your power source, the net comes back to you in the form of cash, which would be great for farming communities, and it's great for people who have a hard time making it work as a farmer. If you could generate electricity and become your own power plant, not to mention what would happen if something were to happen to our grid, if you had enough of these distributive power systems, you would have great opportunities to deal with that kind of problem. The problem we got now in the General Assembly is that we've got a number of people, and God, I hope I don't offend anybody in this room, who are deniers of the science of climate change. And I know there may be somebody here, so I respect people's point of view, but I believe in the science. You look at the science, and you look. It's like going to the doctor. If I send my son to the doctor, somebody's had a lot of training in medicine, and the doctor says that my son has a very bad disease, and I don't like that result, I go and get a second opinion. And if I go get a second opinion from a different doctor, and he tells me the same thing, and I don't like that, I go get another opinion. And if I go to Duke Medical Center, and I ask for another opinion, and it's the same opinion, and I don't like that opinion, well, maybe I go get another opinion. But at some point, if 90% of the people are telling me that something's wrong, and that's what's happening out there. 90%, I venture it's more than that, of the scientists who work in this area say there's a problem. Norfolk is a little different because it's not only subject to sea rise, it's also sinking. So it's not just a climate change problem, it's a problem in the geography. They're going to face it. I don't know when it's going to happen, but, they're already facing problems with storms. So, I would encourage those folks who don't believe in the science, maybe get another opinion. But my opinion, and you hate to say that you can never change your opinion because you learn as a legislator, you learn as a local representative, you got to be open to change your opinion. But all the science tells me right now is we got a problem, and we got to do what we can to solve it.
If we don't, our style of life is going to change dramatically. People say, oh, we're going to have to force our change in style of our life. Well, you know, it may not be our lifestyle that changes, but it could be our grandkids. So,
what is your opinion on, this is going to be a two-part question, on offshore drilling for oil and also for roads like the 29 bypass, which in parentheses says, which doesn't bypass Charlottesville. So,
okay. Well, I don't support offshore drilling. I think that in terms of the costs involved, you know, it's and the risks involved, it's not worth it. I think there are a lot of things we can do with natural gas that were, if you're asking for oil. Now, drilling off the coast for natural gas is a little bit different. I think it's a little bit safer, although we did see some pretty terrible things happen recently. But there's a lot of things in the area of natural gas where natural gas is being developed in the United States and gives us some possibilities for some energy independence we didn't have in the past. And beyond that, I think the renewable energy field is an area that I think long-term is going to bear fruit for us. I mean, we like to think of ourselves as the most technologically advanced country in the world. We got challenges in that regard, but if any country can solve this alternative energy problem challenge, we can. In terms of the bypass, it doesn't bypass anything. You know, that's really out of my control. I mean, I can't believe this. I see Francis in the room. I mean, how many times have we talked about the bypass over the last, how many years, 25 years? You know, when I was on the city council, we were talking about the bypass. Mm-hmm. At that point, I think the council took the position that the bypass wouldn't be built unless all the other alternatives were built first, and it was still proved to be necessary. Well, a little problem happened along the way, and that is that the state decided that they were going to build it, and they got a couple of people on the Board of Supervisors to change their mind. And now it looks like it's going to be built. Now, if it was my druthers, I would build a different kind of road, and I'd build it to the north. I'm not even really sure we need a bypass. We got to create a network of roads. And fortunately, I mean, I know some people disagree with this, too. I mean, the Parkway is part of that network of roads. I know some people disagree with that. Hillsdale is certainly part of that network of roads. Berkmar Extended could be part of that network of roads. The Eastern Connector could be if it was done the right way. I mean, there's some challenges with that, too. But the bypass, that's a state, that's become a state issue. The people in Lynchburg essentially have forced it on us, and I think it's probably going to get built unless there's a lawsuit that succeeds.
Okay. Before we close up and we thank David, does anybody in the room have a nice softball question for David? Oh, we have a hand up.
I don't know if it's softball, but at any rate, I believe it was this morning's newspaper that said that the university might hire students to be like teachers' aides to the professors as part of their package, and that they were relying on federal grants. Well, as a person who had a husband who lived on federal grants, I don't know how often you can rely on that.
Mm-hmm. They've always done it.
I know they've done it, but it doesn't always work.
That's not a softball question. That's a difficult question. Really, it is a difficult question. I mean, I think what the university is trying to cope with is the impacts of the sequester on a lesser amount of funds for work study, for grants to faculty members so that they can hire students. Remember, if students are working, they don't have to borrow as much money. And I think Teresa Sullivan is trying to think about whether we should create a work study program for the state as a whole. Now, she didn't detail her proposal in any great, she didn't do anything more but just sort of throw it out there. I mean, how would you fund it? You know, how would money allocated among universities? But I think there's no denying the fact that we got to figure out a way that students can get access to grants as opposed to just borrowing so much money that they will be under the gun to pay it when they get out of school. And work study is a way to do that. But you got to get the money from somewhere to pay that. And it's not an easy problem, so I don't have the solution. I want to see what the Madam President proposes, and then we'll try to make a judgment about it.
We got one other question.
I've got one you can do with yes or no as an answer.
Is that possible?
Is it or is it not true that the Highway Commissioner wants to run for statewide office, and that's the motivation for building the bypass? Chits in Lynchburg and Danville.
I asked for a softball question.
You know what would happen if you asked that question in court? You get an objection, and the judge and the objection would be calls for speculation. The witness cannot figure out the intent of Sean Connaughton and why he did this. There was some speculation that was what was going on. But he never ran. So I don't know, maybe he's waiting 4 years. I don't know. I really don't.
Well, these need to be in writing if we're going to continue to have questions.
It's quick.
I was looking for one question.
You can ask me afterward, too.
David, quick question.
I'm not in charge of this.
You mentioned
K-12
and higher ed. Is there any chance that pre-K has a chance in the legislature in the near or distant future?
Well, I think if I were running for governor, one of my planks would be universal pre-K for four-year-olds. But I think it's all predicated on the economy, because you got to have money to pay for this thing. And right now, there's not a lot of more money. So you get in this position where you're not going to take money from K-12 to pay for it. So you may take it from some other program to pay for it, or you may raise taxes to pay for it. We just raised taxes for transportation. I don't see us raising taxes again for a while. The one way that we can get more money, however, is if the economy comes back and comes roaring back. You know, in the 90s and the early part of the 2000s, with the exception of a little blip, we were perking along 8% growth. I mean, God, we had so much. I wasn't there then. But they had a lot of money that they could use. And if we got more money, it would be my view that we should put it into that kind of investment. Because everything says, and this is a priority of the Chamber of Commerce, everything says that that's a really good investment for the future of the economy.
Hey, David, we want to thank you for coming today, and I think I speak for everyone in this room. Regardless of your political affiliations, we're very, very fortunate to have a David Toscano representing us, and we truly appreciate all the hard work you do on our behalf.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.